Thanks for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Scheckman. You all remember in the world of James Bond, Q was the fictional character who heads up the also fictional Research and Development Division of the British Secret Service. He conjures up all those amazing and high-tech weapons that Bond has employed since he was dreamt up by Ian Fleming in the early 1950s. On a parallel track in the real world has been the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA. Created by Eisenhower in the late 50s, its mission, too, was to create those science fiction-inspired high-tech weapons, but for the American military. DARPA was, for Eisenhower, Frankenstein-like. His generals created it as the brain of the military-industrial complex, and then Eisenhower warned us of its dangers as he left office. But now, only in the context of my guest Annie Jacobson's book, The Pentagon's Brain, can we see the full scope of what DARPA has accomplished. Annie Jacobson is the author of the bestsellers Area 51 and Operation Paperclip. She was a contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times. It is my pleasure to welcome Annie Jacobson to Radio Who, What, Why to talk about her new book, The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to begin by talking a little bit about the context of the creation of DARPA in the mid to late 1950s, the Cold War going on, and all the fear that had permeated America as a result of what the Russians were doing in the realm of technology and military equipment.
Well, I begin the book with a nuclear weapons test of unbelievable proportions. It was a 15 megaton bomb that was set off by the United States in the Marshall Islands in 1954. And that is 4 years before DARPA was created. This is what DARPA was all about. This weapon that American scientists had created, the thermonuclear weapon, which is just so exponentially more powerful than the atomic bomb. They're in an entirely different category. One's sort of a city ruiner, and the other just takes out a whole seaboard, a whole coast. And so DARPA was created in the strangest military-industrial complex type way to defend against that which it had created, because by the time DARPA was created, the Soviets had the thermonuclear weapon and were also testing it.
There was also fear of space. The space race was just beginning to heat up. Sputnik was a reality, and that was part of the fear as well.
Yes, and it's an important thing to remind people today that, you know, back in the old days, back in World War II, when those atomic bombs were dropped, they were flown on an airplane, and they were kind of, literally, they came out of the bomb bay door. Well, that all changed when space became a viable place to go to, and so the idea that the Soviets sent Sputnik up, and the first space satellite, meant that they had achieved supremacy over the United States in conquering space. But more importantly for DARPA, what it meant was that they had a long-range missile capable of lofting that satellite. And the next thing they were going to be lofting, so the threat went, was a deliverable nuclear, thermonuclear bomb, which had by then been shrunken down to such a small size that it could fit in the nose cone of one of those long-range missiles.
Talk a little bit about Eisenhower and how he envisioned this, and also some of the players, some of the generals that were really at the forefront of suggesting the creation of DARPA.
Well, it's very interesting that you say generals, and I loved your intro. It's not as much the generals that were gunning for DARPA as it was the nuclear weapons producers. They were the early defense contractors, the Livermore, the Edward Teller. These guys were making nuclear weapons, and they wanted DARPA because DARPA was the perfect place to keep that military-industrial complex flourishing. And so the sense is that the generals are really doing a different kind of job at the Pentagon, and that the science and the research, what is called, what DARPA has become known for, is called pre-requirement research, meaning doing, imagining weapons before they're even necessary. That is what the defense contractors do.
It's ironic that those were the people that were behind this, the nuclear weapons people, because so much of what DARPA tried to do was figure out ways to neutralize nuclear weapons from the other side.
Well, yes, but there is the inherent, you know, dichotomy of the military-industrial complex, which is that you must have a weapon that is, you know, that is greater than or more supreme than the enemy, but then inevitably the enemy will gather that weapon's technology for themselves, and by then you must already be on to a new technology. Nowhere is a better example that people can relate to today is drone technology, because drones, although they were invented by DARPA way back during the Vietnam War, when they were unveiled on the battlefield in Afghanistan during the War on Terror, you know, people were astounded, and now 186 nations have armed drones.
Talk about the ways in which DARPA began to move beyond the nuclear weapons aspect to all of the other research, all of the other areas that it began to get involved in.
And that happened immediately, because the nuclear weapons threat was just one element of it. It was called ballistic missile defense, because really what we were defending against was those ballistic missiles that would be carrying the nuclear weapon. But there were also so many other elements that DARPA got involved in right away, the first few years, which were then immediately shifted by the problem, which is what it was called at the time, in Vietnam. And then DARPA took a very different turn. Instead of being involved in these big space-related, you know, defense issues, suddenly DARPA was now in the business of making weapons and using science and technology in the jungles of Vietnam to try to win this, you know, covert war. And that's where things got really interesting, certainly from a historical point of view.
And that's where it also develops this almost science fiction quality in terms of the things that they were trying to do.
They gave their scientists long leashes. I mean, they were called program managers back then, and the program managers would actually hire the scientists and the engineers. And it was this incredibly gung-ho way of sort of an idea that the march of war would be conquered by technology. And so, yes, you had these scientists literally in the jungle working on crazy programs, from these early drones to, you know, how to retrofit a jeep so that it could go through the jungle, to how to glide silently over the jungle canopy so that the Viet Cong fighters on the ground couldn't hear it. All these early technologies began in Vietnam.
There's also the human interface part of it. Lots of robotics that were looked at the time, brain implants, chips, so many things that came right out of the science fiction of the time.
You know, there's an incredibly interesting weapons program that was born in Vietnam that is, as far as I could tell, really overlooked by military historians. And it has to do, and it has led us, by the way, to exactly what you're talking about, where we are now with this incredible technology with robots and brain implants. But it came from Vietnam, centered around a program that Robert McNamara, then Secretary of Defense, fostered. And it was called the McNamara electronic fence. And at the time, it was belittled as an idea. The plan was to create a system of sensors, and I'm talking about, let's say, audio sensors and seismic sensors and magnetic sensors, to try and hear and see what the Viet Cong fighters were doing in the jungle along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was so far advanced in 1966 when the idea first began, and yet the Jason scientists, this group of nuclear physicists who are very secretive, very powerful, and I write about at length in the book, the Jason scientists worked with McNamara to come up with this idea of that we could somehow see the unseen, hear the unheard using high technology. And it was really laughed at by the generals. They disliked the program and did not support it. It went ahead anyways. It didn't do a whole lot of good in Vietnam. But after the Vietnam War, that technology took off. And what it is today is absolutely remarkable.
in many ways, ARPANET was a similar kind of thing. What is really the internet today that came out of that research?
Yes, and that is exactly tied in with, you know, sort of the confluence of technologies that bring us to today. So here's the example. The ARPANET was created because there was a fellow named J.C.R. Licklider, who is often called the father of the internet. And he was brought into the Pentagon in 1962, literally to deal with a problem that the Pentagon had, which was called command and control, C2. And the idea was that if there was a nuclear, you know, the president had to make a decision, go, no go, in a nuclear launch, the only technology that he had to make that decision was a red telephone, like literally an analog telephone that you dialed. And Congress said, this is unacceptable, we have to get better technology. So Licklider is brought into it was then called ARPA. He's brought into the Pentagon to run this office, command and control for ARPA. And out of that idea, he comes up with what he calls an idea for an intergalactic network, which became what was called ARPANET and is now called the Internet. And it was this idea that you could use different nodes with computers attached to them to be able to ultimately communicate and control weapon systems in the Pentagon better, which is so ironic that now the Internet is this incredible place of freedom of expression and the ability for people to have transparency among themselves. So that is one of the more ironic situations where a weapon system actually becomes really a very democratic tool for the people.
And of course, some place where there's the ability for people to hack into the Pentagon, into the military as well.
Yes, but what's so fascinating about this sensor technology, during the Vietnam War, these scientists were, you know, planting these giant sensors. I mean, imagine what you have now in an audio sensor that literally is the size of your fingernail. That in 1967 was the size of a chair, okay? And you had aircraft flying over the jungle dropping these sensors out of the aircraft. They were shaped kind of like a missile, like a dart, and they would land in the jungle. The aircraft would drop a whole string of them, like a hundred of them in a row. And then that technology would then send a signal up to another aircraft that was rotating around in a racetrack formation. And that information would go back to an information center in Thailand. So you'd have these guys listening to the jungle fighters on the trail. Well, doesn't this sound incredibly familiar when you think about surveillance situations today, except for that they're incredibly advanced and they're incredibly small?
There are also more primitive kinds of things that came out of it, things like Agent Orange, for example.
You know, Agent Orange was this deadly, noxious chemical that ARPA decided might help, might kind of be, they called it a magic bullet. It might be a magic bullet, was one of the quotes I came across, for winning this war in Vietnam, because the idea was you would spray it out of aircraft. The aircraft were designed to look like they were part of the South Vietnamese Army, but in fact they were manufactured by the Americans. And you would spray this horrific chemical over the jungle canopy and defoliate all the leaves. And then we would be able to see the fighters on the trail. This was before we came up with the idea of the sensors, and it later worked in concert. And this was, of course, a terrible, noxious poison. And DARPA had no idea at the time, you could say, or you could say DARPA should have known the science behind this before it went ahead and put this giant program into play, which caused so many deaths and disfigurations.
Talk a little bit about how Eisenhower saw this after it was created, when he began to see what it was that it was doing, and what Eisenhower thought about it, how it led to his concern about the military-industrial complex, and what subsequent administrations have thought about DARPA.
You know, I think Eisenhower was such a great president, and he came into the office with so much experience in World War II, having commanded the forces in Europe. And he, you know, he was such a wise man, and he was really in a predicament in this age of of science and technology moving faster than any single person could really comprehend. And yet Eisenhower, being the president of America, had the most at stake to comprehend that. He surrounded himself by scientists. He really sought out the best, and he worked very hard to learn about the different technologies that were going on. And, you know, there was only so much he could do. So by the time he gave that famous farewell speech in 1961, where he warns about the military-industrial complex, he's already, you know, 8 years in, and he already knows that the defense contractors have become embedded with the Pentagon and with this idea of future war. But he says an interesting thing, which I find hopeful. The second part of his speech, which is really not quoted that often, says that it's actually okay that the military-industrial complex can exist side by side with democracy. It's just that citizens must maintain a very serious degree of knowledge and alertness, is what he says. So in other words, you just have to be aware of what your government is doing. That's part of the reason why I wrote The Pentagon's Brains, so that Americans today can see, oh wow, this is what my government has been up to in terms of weapons development since 1958, and wow, look where we are now, and where are we actually going? Because that's the big question in the end.
Part of what drives that question, and in many ways drove the evolution of DARPA, is that the complexity of the nexus between science and the military just increased exponentially over the years.
I mean, it's just so remarkable. I'll give you a detail that kind of sums it up, because DARPA's trajectory has so much to do with computer technology. I mean, we talked about the internet. The internet is predicated on there being computers that people can actually connect together. So go imagine this. John von Neumann was a scientist who was very important during World War II, and he essentially was the Pentagon's first brain. There was no individual who the Pentagon relied upon more for, you know, brainiac-type answers than John von Neumann in the 1950s. He was very good friends with the first DARPA director, Herb York. And von Neumann created one of the very first computers, which was called the MANIAC, and it was at Princeton Institute for Advanced Science. But here's what's interesting. Back in 1946, when von Neumann created this computer, and by the way, it weighed 1,000 pounds, it was 8 feet tall and 6 feet wide, that was like shrunken down version of the computer that had been used on the Manhattan Project. So von Neumann created this really small computer. And what was interesting is before this computer, computers were actually humans. So in other words, John von Neumann was a computer. He was a human computer. His brain did the math. And during the war, he did a lot of the bomb trajectories for the government, because this is what it would take. It took a mathematical mind, a pen, and a paper. That was a computer. And suddenly, von Neumann is part of the original group of people that invents, in essence, the computer. And von Neumann would stand there in the basement of Princeton, and he and the computer would do tests with one another. And in the beginning, he was able to beat the mechanical computer because his brain could calculate that fast. And then one day, in about 1947, von Neumann erred. He made a mistake, which is what humans do, and the computer didn't. And that was this incredible moment in history where suddenly computers were no longer human. Now we find ourselves in this very strange time as we move toward artificial intelligence, where the big question is, will computers overtake humans?
How much of what DARPA did was in total secrecy, and how much of it, because of the nature of science and scientists, constantly was making its way into public consciousness, the private sector, and in places where it was no longer secret?
Well, that's always an interesting journey for the journalist like me to figure that out and to look at that and to really try and figure out what that means for the reader. And it's a great question, because when you realize that almost everything that DARPA did of merit was classified when it was going on, In other words, they had some programs that they were talking about, but those programs were almost like the veil of the real program. And so the major programs, as they become declassified 25, 35 years later, and many of them still aren't, by the way, then you begin to realize, well, there's always programs behind programs. And so as it has been with all three of my books now, Area 51, Operation Paperclip, and now The Pentagon's Brain, I'm always aware of, wow, I'm finding stuff out that's been classified for 35 years, so what does it really mean about the programs that I'm talking about that exist now that are made public? What are the programs behind those programs? I mean, for example, one thing that many scientists talked to me about was that DARPA may very well, now this is speculation, be cloning, because we're working on human cloning technology, because there actually is no law against human cloning. It's just looked down upon for moral reasons. But I was surprised to learn that. And then I was surprised by a scientist that said to me, when I sort of raised my eyebrows and said, well, human cloning, I mean, the American public should know about that if we're doing that research. And he said to me, how would you feel if another nation were to break that technology barrier before the United States and announce that they had created the first human clone? America would lose its supremacy in terms of always being in the pole position of science. There again is that double-edged sword of DARPA.
How has DARPA continued in a more globalized world, in a world where the internet does exist, where contacts and connections between scientists and science moves around the world at the speed of light, in a world that was far less siloed than the world that created DARPA? Talk about the ways in which that's had an impact.
Well, DARPA has been there all along. So DARPA is bigger than it has ever been, in as much that I think so many of these industries we've been talking about, DARPA has actually created. And it's created them with that pre-requirement research in mind, with the idea that we're going to need these systems in the future, therefore we're going to build them. So I think that DARPA doesn't just exist in the future, DARPA actually creates the future.
Annie Jacobson, I thank you so much for spending time with us here at Radio Who, What, Why.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.